morning. You're listening to The Coffee Table. I'm Daisha Eaton, KBBI News Director. We're talking about emergency preparedness this morning. Earlier this month, we had a magnitude 7.1 earthquake, and that quake was centered just 60 miles west of Homer. The shaking was followed by leaking gas that caused explosions and fires that destroyed four houses in Kenai. So on this week's Coffee Table, we're going to review what happened, and we'll talk with emergency preparedness experts to think about how we can be ready for the next big one. We're joined today by Bob Painter, Chief of the Homer Fire Department, Scott Walden with the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management, and Jeremy Zidek with the Alaska Division of Homeland Security. And we'll be taking your questions today. First, we're going to get started with introductions. We have Bob Painter, Chief of the Homer Fire Department, right here in the studio. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning.
And on the phone, I believe we have Jeremy Zidek with the Alaska Division of Homeland Security. Jeremy.
Hi, Daisha. Good to be here with you this morning.
Thanks for joining us. And I believe we may have Scott Walden on the phone with us, too. Is that right?
We do, and I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you, Daisha.
Yes, thanks for being here. So you guys are kind of the top experts for the state and the borough and for our little town of Homer here, so we're really happy you joined us. Can you just go ahead, and I introduced you briefly, but can you just tell the listeners over the airwaves a little bit more about your job and what you do? We can go ahead and start with Bob here in the studio.
Okay, sure. As the fire chief for the city of Homer, one of my other jobs is as the director of emergency services, and what that entails is being the de facto emergency manager for the city of Homer. And as such, since I became chief in 2000, I've been striving to learn more and more about emergency management and how people can be better prepared in our community and across the state.
Great, thank you. And then we'll go into the phone line here. and I'll just ask you, Scott Walden with the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management, can you tell us a little bit about your job?
Yeah. Like Bob, I'm the Director of Emergency Management, but for the Kenai Peninsula Borough. So outside of the cities, our job is to provide coordination of response with resources, and also when resources aren't readily available, to be that point of contact to go up the chain to the state or federal level to obtain appropriate resources. We work real closely with Chief Painter and the other chiefs in the cities of Soldotna, Kenai, and Homer and Seward. We also try to stay in touch with the villages across the bay and across Cook Inlet and the smaller communities, Cooper Landing, Hope, Moose Pass. So we have a pretty good area that we serve in a similar fashion to what Bob does for the city.
And I imagine you're in touch with Jeremy Zidek, too, at the Department of Homeland Security when something big like this happens.
Always.
So we'll go to him next. Jeremy, can you tell our listeners just a little bit about what you do and how you're involved with disaster preparedness and emergency management?
Sure. We're the state of Alaska's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Sometimes people hear that Homeland Security and think that we're, you know, chasing terrorists. But we do a little bit of that interfacing with local law enforcement. But really our primary purpose is to be the state's emergency management agency. When communities need some type of help, they can call upon the state. We'll muster the state's resource and try to provide that for that critical need for that community. Before any disaster happens, though, we work with communities to help them develop plans. We have several grant programs that we can then provide some funding, so communities can go out and purchase equipment, fund personnel, conduct exercises and drills, test those plans, provide training, and then after we've done all that, we'll review that plan again and see if we can make it a little bit better and start the process over again.
All right. Well, I was wondering if we could just kind of start by reviewing what happened during this 7.1 magnitude earthquake that happened not too long ago. I know we all woke up in the middle of the night. I know I sat right up in bed and was shaken awake. My dog was barking. My car alarm was going off. And, you know, I'm someone who thinks about preparing for an emergency. I knew my job was to come in to KBBI and to start, you know, talking with authorities to try to verify information, to try to get the word out that there was no tsunami warning in this case. But not everybody is thinking like that. And I was pretty shaken up. And that earthquake just kept on going. How did we do as a community, a region, a state? Can you give us a little report card on how we did during this past earthquake just a couple of weeks ago?
Deja, this is Scott. From the borough, my Office of Emergency Management's perspective, you know, we were shaken awake like everybody else, and as soon as the shaking stopped, we were able to make calls across the peninsula to verify conditions, essentially, and Chief Painter was one of the first people I contacted. We contacted the emergency services in all the far reaches of the borough. We tried to contact each village as we could, just to get a preliminary damage assessment to make sure that no one was injured, needed assistance. And we also were working within just a few minutes with the Alaska State Troopers, Department of Transportation, to evaluate bridges and get reports of the conditions of bridges and make sure that our infrastructure was still passable. And about that time, we also realized that we had two significant issues to direct our resources to, and one was the road on Kalifornsky Beach that had lost a section of road, and the other was the city of Kenai's response with assistance from the Kiski Fire to the fires and explosion on Lilac Street over in the northern section of Kenai. So our job at that point was to direct media calls to the appropriate people at the state level and to the city level, and then to be able to provide information to the community as it came in, as far as that there was no tsunami, and follow up with a lot of questions on what they should have done in preparation. But we also participated in sheltering. We set up a shelter for the people that had to be evacuated in Kenai, and we worked closely with Jeremy's office up at the State Emergency Operations Center to fill them in on our preliminary damage assessments from the cities and unincorporated areas, the sheltering issue, and the two responses that were active on the peninsula. We also worked with the school district to start looking at all the school buildings to make sure that Monday they were safe to go back to. And we had our capital projects, public works people, and some engineers look through borough facilities as well for that same reason. And the cities did the same. Each city in Chief Painter's area did a good job of that as well. So that's generally what we did in the first, as soon as the shaking stopped.
So I'm guessing that was all part of a plan that you had in place ahead of time.
We communicate with each other a lot, city to city. Chief Painter's city has got a good preparedness plan in place, and our office relies a lot. If you look at the website where the emergency operations plans are available for public viewing, not only does the borough have one, but ours and the city's all linked together in one fashion or another for this very purpose.
And so, Scott, it sounds like a lot of things that were supposed to happen happened. What kind of grade would you give the borough and your organization at responding to this emergency?
Well, I can tell you that whether a fire chief was in his city or elsewhere, they were able to report to us preliminary damages or lack of. So it was very efficient in that fashion. They knew what condition their communities were. And they were able to express whether or not they needed help. As far as those that had to go respond and take care of specific issues, it was amazing how quickly those things were taken care of from the DOT and Alaska State Trooper side, as far as looking at bridges and other areas. Our road service area did the same. But the response in Kenai was phenomenal for the public safety folks, in addition to the support they had from their own public works. And then the Alaska Guard, the Armory, was right there to help with the sheltering. So I would say that area-wide, these plans that we talk about all year long, at least from our responder level, worked fairly well. And I don't want to forget that or leave out the fact that Jeremy's office in Anchorage was a big player in this, because they were not only constantly calling down here to verify that we were still in good shape, but they were also checking everywhere else in the state for that same purpose. finally, I would say, though this earthquake is rumored to be the largest ever recorded in Lower Cook Inlet, we were all very fortunate in the results of that, with minor damage and no real injuries reported.
And Chief Painter, I know here in Homer we were very lucky, just as Scott's been explaining. How did things work here in Homer with our plan? I know you were you out of town when this happened?
I was. Scott alluded to the fact that that I was out of town. I rode this out up in Anchorage. And what's amazing is even that far away, we were pretty much, the entire area was awakened about 1:30 by the earthquake. But within a few minutes, I was already receiving text messages from the Tsunami Warning Center about the magnitude and the potential for tsunami, and none was expected, which is always good news. Very soon after that, I received a call from Scott Walden asking about anything that I had heard. And at that point in time, had not received any calls from our dispatch or any of my personnel reporting any significant damage, either to our own infrastructure, our station and equipment, or to any significant damage throughout the city. So my assumption is at that point in time that we rode it out fairly well. And just go about normal routine business.
And Jeremy, how about from a statewide perspective? A lot of the shaking was felt strongly down here, and the damage was down this way. How did we do as a state, and how did the state work with the Kenai Peninsula Borough and this region?
You know, I think it worked really well. It worked as we designed it. What we want is first local governments to respond, those city emergency managers to activate their forces, and then we want the borough to start communicating with the state agencies that are in that area and then feed information up to us at the State Emergency Operations Center so we can determine if we need to muster any additional resources. But really, things have to happen at a local level first, and we saw that with this event. Would add, though, that we got pretty lucky with the location of this earthquake. It was somewhat far away and a pretty deep earthquake, but a 7.1 earthquake is a really large earthquake, and if we, you know, miles away, we felt that strong shaking. Even up here in Anchorage, it was pretty a good shaker. And we see earthquakes down in California, 6.5, 6.4s. They do a lot more damage in those populated areas. We also see places like Christchurch, New Zealand, that was hit by a series of earthquakes in that 7.0 range. And those caused a lot of significant damage. So while we responded very well, Alaska is a really seismically active region, and we really need to take this as a learning moment and say, just because we responded well doesn't mean that we can kind of sit back and say, well, we'll be okay for the next one, because it could be much closer, much more shallow, and close to our population centers.
And that leads into my next question is, we did pretty well, it sounds like, with our response, and we also were very lucky with the situation. But how can we do better? Say we have a shallower earthquake or an even stronger earthquake or both. Where could we do better?
You know, Deisha, this is Scott again. Every time an incident occurs, whether it's a wildland fire, a flood, or in this case, the earthquake, and though, I guess, like Jeremy said, we did kind of dodge a bullet statewide, what we try to do as a group is to sit down with each other or send a report up to where they can be consolidated that says, after action-wise, here's some things that went really good, and here's some things that could have used some improvement. And there's always room for improvement at the responder level. We learn something every time something like this occurs. One of the things that, for example, that I learned was, and only one, I'm just mentioning one thing, but there are a number of things that we learned throughout this process, was that people refreshed their need to be prepared and there was a heavy influx of phone calls over the subsequent few days about where can we get information related to what we should actually do in any disaster. So we reminded them to go to appropriate websites like ours and the state's, and even the city, each city has some information on it, and ask them to look through there for their specific needs, pull out what they need, they can print off what they want, put on their refrigerator, and if they don't have it, let us know, and or can't find what they're looking for, we'll certainly supply that information or even come to a community and do further presentations. One of the things that I think is vital in an issue like this is not only for individuals to be prepared, but for our business community to be prepared for their continuity of operations. It's pretty reassuring if you can walk out your door and find some devastation in your neighborhood, but look down the street and see an open sign still there, and somebody's still there to help you out in some fashion. It's vital to our economy, and it's vital to our response, really, to have these businesses be prepared for these events, to be able to open at least on some small scale. And we saw that that did happen here when we were trying to feed the sheltered people. The Salvation Army stepped up to help us with that, but the stores had a lot of merchandise on the floor and weren't able to have the Salvation Army come in and get supplies for an hour or two. We were fortunate that those stores had a continuity plan that was able to get themselves back open within a few hours in most cases. So those kinds of things I learned was people know their memory fades. These things jar their senses to where they want to refresh on what they should be doing for their family, and they're eager to do it. So our job is after action-wise, to lead them to that right information.
Great. So have a plan for your own household, your own business, your own organization. Have an emergency supply kit, and we're going to get into that a little bit more as we move on. Jeremy, would you like to add anything about how we could do better?
Well, like Scott said, we'll go back and take a look at how things went and make sure that we did the things that we planned for, and if there's any areas of improvement that we can hit upon those. Like Scott said, it is important that we have a plan, and it's not a difficult thing to do with the individual or the family on the family level. It's really just sitting down, talking to one another, having that conversation. What are we going to do if there was another earthquake like that? What would we have done if the damage was greater and everyone was at work or school? And for the individual and family, that's really kind of key. Even building the emergency kit, most of that stuff is already in your home, and you just have to take some time to kind of consolidate it and make sure you have enough supplies.
And that's another good point, Jeremy. This happened in the middle of the night, so we were all at home. We weren't in our cars. We weren't at work. That was, in some ways, although we were sleepy when we woke up and maybe a little in shock, that was fortunate, I think, in some ways. Let's go to Chief Painter. How did the city of Homer do? We didn't have much damage here, but how did we do in our response? And how can we do better?
I think it went very well. Like I said, we weren't overwhelmed with phone calls. When I got into work Monday morning, I had no phone calls, voice messages waiting for me regarding the earthquake. We subsequently had a structure fire a little later that morning, which the cause of the fire is still under investigation. It may or may not have been related to the earthquake because the house was not being lived in at the time. So that's still a question mark. I have to parrot what Scott brought up, is that the first thing you need to do is have a plan, and not only for home but for work and when you're away. And that's one lesson that I learned. I said I was up in Anchorage, and we got into Anchorage pretty late, so we grabbed a bite to eat, checked in the hotel, and 1:30 that morning, there's a 7.1 earthquake. If I had needed to, I could not have gotten back home with the amount of fuel I had left in my vehicle. So my lesson learned was to keep the tank closer to the F than to the E for when I can't get fuel again. I need to at least have enough fuel, if possible, to get back home. If the roads are passable. And that would have been a question mark because we did lose power in Anchorage. and it was out for several hours where I was anyway, and no power, no gas station.
And today we're talking about emergency preparedness. You're listening to The Coffee Table on KBBI. I'm Daisha Eaton, KBBI News Director. I'm here with Chief Bob Painter of the Homer Fire Department. Scott Walden is on the line with the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management, and Jeremy Zidek, also on the line with the Alaska Division of Homeland Security. We're talking about the recent 7.1 magnitude earthquake and how things went as far as emergency response and how we can do better. We're going to open up the telephone lines now for you to call in and ask these experts on emergency management some questions that you may have. The local number is 907-235-7721. The toll-free number is 1-800-979-5224. And now we actually have some callers already. I'm not surprised, since so many people felt this and may have some questions. We have Tom on line two. He has some questions about the electrical grid, which you were just getting at, Chief Painter.
Hello. Hello there. I'm sorry.
Oh.
This is not Tom.
Well, this is Dorla. I recognize your voice. Thanks for calling in.
I guess Tom hung up.
You have a question about the gas line, right?
I have a question about the gas line. What is in place for a bigger earthquake or a wildfire if the gas line has a leak and breaks? I know you can shut it off at your house, but if it's anywhere away from your wall and from your meter, is there a way to shut off sections of the whole gas line?
This is Scott. That's a very good question. And in fact, Sunday we met to give the governor a brief on what the damages were and heard from NSTAR specifically about that topic. Interestingly, during these things, like we have plans, companies like Tesoro, who have major liquid gas lines that they transmit to Anchorage, have a plan to be able to isolate those to protect them from leaking or breaking. NSTAR has the ability to isolate certain areas and sections. But as far as the homeowners, what should a homeowner do? They stressed two important things. One is, if you smell that mercaptan, which is an odorant they put in the natural gas — natural gas itself is generally not odorized, but NSTAR odorizes it so you can tell — if you smell that in your house after an earthquake, that you should crack a window open so that there is some circulation of air to keep the level of the gas at a lower level, and you should leave the building. Don't make phone calls. Don't switch light switches. Just leave your home and go to a safe place and call 911. What we would do once a 911 call comes through is deploy NSTAR resources to check your home specifically and check your neighborhood also. And that's what happened in the case in Kenai. Right along the lines of your question, was the fire department responded to a house fire. Within minutes of getting there and evacuating people, within minutes of evacuation, there were some explosions in a couple of homes that had a lot of gas in them. Fortunately, there were no injuries, and NSTAR was on the scene within minutes to help isolate the gas lines in that neighborhood without shutting off unrelated neighborhoods. So they do have a corporate plan for that purpose, and it's across the entire natural gas grid for domestic service that's effective.
Oh, good. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So, Scott, just to be clear, actually shut off the gas at their house?
NSTAR recommended that, it is possible to do that. There is a way to do that, and NSTAR will come out into your neighborhood and show you how to do that so that it's done properly. But what they like to do is to come back to help relight everything. They don't want the homeowners taking responsibility for reactivating gas to their home and lighting appliances. So what they recommend is that you open a window and leave the home and don't make an effort to turn off the gas meter. That may not be the problem, and they'll send somebody to do that.
So you can shut off the gas, but NSTAR prefers that you just get out for safety reasons and call 911, and then they'll handle it.
That is correct. And if an individual has a desire to learn how to shut their gas off for whatever that reason is, they should call NSTAR directly and ask for that training.
Okay.
Yeah, this is Jeremy. I would also echo that in addition to getting that training from NSTAR,
to go and locate where the water comes into your home if you're on some type of city water, and discovering how you can shut that off, also looking at your electrical panel and how you can shut that off. In case there are problems with your utility, you can shut them off quickly. In addition to gas leaks and fires from the gas leaks after an earthquake, we see a lot of water damage after earthquakes. And in addition to the damage that the earthquake causes, we don't want to have that secondary damage. So if you know how to shut those utilities off before the earthquake happens, you don't have to go and search for that when it has occurred. You can just go to it and activate it.
So if you want to learn how to do that, you can call NSTAR. You can call, in this case, HEA, mm-hmm. about the electric. You can talk to your landlord, or, you know, to find out about your water situation. Correct?
Yes. And if you go to their websites, you know, Homer Electric and NSTAR, there is a safety page on there that will describe do's and don'ts and supplies that you would need if you do choose to shut off your natural gas.
And my understanding is, just looking at large earthquakes that have happened around the world, it's not always, especially in the developed world, in the United States, it's not always the big shaking that causes the most damage anymore, because we have a lot of earthquake safe structures. It's often the stuff that happens afterwards, like gas leaks, like fires, like flooding. Is that right?
Yeah. If you look at on a small scale, what happened in this earthquake with Kalifornsky Beach Road losing one lane. You know, it's not unreasonable to think if we had another earthquake like the 1964 quake that we could lose access to bridges. We could isolate certain areas of the peninsula, and people would be a lot more self-sufficient than they would expect. So there, it's a good idea for folks to be aware of their surroundings. When you go stand in your driveway and look around and see where those power lines might be overhead, or look at the tree that's leaning a little bit and see if maybe a shaker is going to dump it over onto your house, and maybe you want to work on that this summer and take care of that. There's a lot of, after the earthquake occurs, what should you consider? The evacuees, for example, there was a cross-section of infants to toddlers to grade school kids, in addition to older people and some people that needed special medical care. Many of them were fortunate enough to be able to grab their medications and go when they needed to, and were set for a few days. Those kinds of things are important for people to remember. If you have that 7-day kit, you probably have a lot of supplies you would need for after a quake. But it's always a good idea to go through that emergency supply list and put in a reminder, a checklist for yourself on what should I do after this occurs, whether it's taking care of your home or having the medications in a bag, whatever that may be.
Yeah, and typically after disasters, it's not always the disaster event that is the biggest problem. If you look at something like the San Francisco earthquake in 1918, which was a long time ago, but you know, it caused a number of fires that pretty much burnt down the entire city. And we do see this cascading effect from any type of disaster. And sometimes those secondary effects, and secondary and then third and fourth kind of generation of effects, can really have some lasting impacts on the community.
And we're going to go to another phone call. I believe we have Jeff on line two with another question about the gas line.
Hello?
Hello, Jeff. You're on the air. Hi. You had a question about the gas line?
Yeah, I'm just curious, mechanically, where did it fail and who's that on? Is NSTAR liable? Can we look at our own connections and go, let's beef that up or make a change? Or is it just, you know, like, what? That's my question.
Well, I'd have to let NSTAR answer a lot of those, but I can tell you that they're still cooperating in an investigation to see what exactly happened. There's really no determination yet of what the origin or the cause of that was, other than it was very coincidental with this large earthquake. But as far as the neighborhood was actually one of the older original neighborhoods in Kenai, you know, taking into account how many earthquakes has the pipeline gone through, and they do regular maintenance on those as well to make sure that they're stable. In the Homer area, I think you're looking at a whole different situation in that it's a newer system and probably monitored a bit differently. But the fact is that even in this old one, in this old section of town, the response was immediate, and the actions were, they were very positive in what they needed to do to control the situation, because it's a pipe, it goes from here to here. If there's a leak, here's what we do. They have the same motions to go through in every case. I think that if you have an interest in asking NSTAR those questions specifically about what should you be concerned about as a community, you should call NSTAR and ask them those things. I would feel free to do that if I were you. They're very open about their system and what transpired in this case.
This is Jeremy. I do know that there are kind of earthquake-triggered emergency gas valves that can shut off the gas coming to your home. And again, I would contact NSTAR, see what their policy is on that. And I think they're available online, probably at plumbing supply places as well.
So the jury is still out. We really don't know exactly what happened yet with the houses in Kenai and the explosions. Is that right?
That's correct. And that's not unusual in structure fires on a normal day. Or a wildland fire, it can take some time to determine exactly what transpired.
Yeah, this is Bob with the City of Homer, and I want to definitely say, you know, we are benefited by the fact that the gas line down to Homer is new by all intents and purposes. So all of the line is HDPE, which is a very resilient material. And to my knowledge, we had no incidents of failures or leaks in our jurisdiction. Along with that, there are one of the criteria, the design criteria for the gas line install in Homer was that we required a larger number of valves that could help isolate and shut areas off without having to shut a large number of homes or businesses off at one time. So I think we've probably got the largest number of isolation valves in any system that NSTAR has installed in the last 10 years. Along with that, I know that there are some design shutoff valves in the system that NSTAR did install that sense a free flow of gas, and if there, say you were to rupture a line to your home and the gas were to suddenly start free flowing, this valve will automatically shut off. The only hazard with that is if you routinely run gas at the upper limits of what you're rated for, what the pipe diameter is rated for, that valve may not sense that it's a leak and shut off. But as Jeremy said, there are alternatives. I know some jurisdictions in California, which we all know is seismically active as well, is called gas flow shutoff devices, and they're installed between the meter and the home, right just near the meter, and they are seismically activated and they do shut off automatically. So that's something, if you're very concerned about the gas in your home, you can investigate. They do need to be installed by a licensed plumber and probably approved by the gas company itself as far as being compatible with their line.
And Daisha, one more point for the community is they can go to NSTARNaturalGas, it's all one word, .com, and they have a safety and education link on there specifically for everything from reporting it to what is natural gas, how you shut off your meter, all those kinds of things are included on their website.
Great, thank you. We're talking emergency preparedness and earthquake response today on the show. I'm here in the studio with Homer Fire Chief Bob Painter, and we have Steve Walden with the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management on the phone, along with Jeremy Zidek with the Alaska Division of Homeland Security. Real quick, I wanted to just touch on the electrical grid. We did have a lot of power outages all the way up into down here in Homer and all the way up into the Matsu and around Anchorage, of course, Kenai and Soldotna area. How did we do as far as the power grid goes? And I'll let you guys talk about that. Go ahead.
This is Scott again, and I'm not trying to intrude on Jeremy and Chief Painter, but NSTAR and HEA both stay in close contact with our office when these things occur, and they were able to offer an explanation for there was about 5,000 meters affected from Nikiski to Homer, and many were in Kisilov and in the Nikiski area. And as far as the grid itself, it seemed to function as it was designed. You know, there's a tie-in and a link between the Chugach Electric and the HEA, and when their circuits change at the Chugach one and lock out the HEA one, it islands the peninsula so that we're not sharing or relying on power from elsewhere. But it's a safety feature, and HEA takes action to make sure that the frequency of the power stays consistent and everything continues operating as it should. The explanation that they gave Sunday as far as why did that Nikiski area and the Kisilov area suffer the consequences of outages was that the transformers, you know, they have an oil inside of them, and this earthquake actually sloshed the oil, for lack of a better word, to the point where the overfill gauge or the sensor shut down the transformer. So there wasn't a failure in the system. The safety features activated, and they reacted to the sloshing caused by this severe jolting of the earthquake. And that's why it was a fairly quick process to get the power back up and running.
Okay. Well, let's go to another caller. We have Jessica, and she's talking about post-earthquake shelter. Hi, Jessica.
Yeah, hi.
You're on the air. You had a question or a comment about post-earthquake shelter?
Well, yeah, I think that my company, Nomad Shelter, here in Homer, we manufacture yurts, and we've been manufacturing yurts for 20 years in state, and pretty much every time there's a major fire disaster, we get a call at some point or another from someone related to the fire asking us if we have any yurts in stock, you know, for fire relief. And or both for the firefighters and for the disaster survivors. And so my husband designed a product called a yurt in a box, which is a yurt where the floor becomes the crate for the yurt is a 4x8 crate. It becomes the floor of the yurt. The crate contains an insulated yurt with a wood stove and stack in there. So it's pretty much a box containing a shelter that could be choppered in or trucked in or whatever and available. We've tried to get emergency services and our state to purchase container van of these to have in stock, and we haven't been successful. So we've decided to do it on our own. There's a fire. There was a big disaster in Butte, California, where there was some 400 residences that were destroyed. So we started an Indiegogo down there, where people can purchase these or donate towards the purchase of one of these yurts, yurt in a boxes, and then they will be donated to the fire survivors.
Okay, Jessica, did you have a question for our emergency managers?
Yes, I do have. Well, you know, I'm thinking that in response to the fact that we're all linked up to a grid system that will go down in a major disaster, and one of the major things that does happen in a disaster is a fire, and so in response to the fact that NSTAR, you know, is responsible for that, and HEA is responsible for that, I think that it would be. I just wanted to get that news out.
Okay.
That
yeah, but did you have a question? Did you have a question?
We have actually a Homer-made.
Okay.
Homer-made.
I hear
product.
You. You're promoting your product. Thanks for calling. But if you don't have a question, we're going to move on. Thank you.
I have a suggestion for anybody who may have that kind of question.
Yeah.
Locally, there's really not the ability to buy and store those kinds of things. But in a disaster situation where we go from a local to a state to a federal, when it gets to the federal level, there is a possibility that if it was a large-scale disaster, that FEMA Region 10 may start looking for that kind of a resource. And I believe FEMA Region 10 on their website may have a place for you to list your company as a possible resource to be evaluated for that purpose. I can't guarantee it, but that's one option. The other one is related to the wildland services, the fires in the state and the housing of crews. The state forestry under the Department of Natural Resources has a section on their website called OLAS, O-L-A-S. It's an abbreviation for what, I don't know. But what it means is if you're a business and you have a contract service or a service that can be provided, if you list yourself on OLAS, if forestry needs your service, they'll call you and ask for those directly in an emergency.
Okay, so
that's probably the two best ways to get that kind of a product out there.
There's your answer, Jessica. Thank you. So let's start talking about, besides a yurt in a box, what other people, you know, local individual people, businesses, homes, you know, you say we're talking about like everybody should have an emergency kit in their house. What do you mean by that? Am I thinking of like a shoebox? Am I thinking of about a tote? Or am I thinking about something larger? How could this emergency preparedness kit for your home or business look? We're putting together one here at KBBI, and you know, we're looking at filling totes with certain items on a list. So if you could just give some examples of what someone could do either at a home or a business to really prepare for this and what that looks like. Who'd like to go first?
I'll go. This is Jeremy. I'll go first. You know, in the lower 48, they say that people should have enough supplies for 3 days. But if you look at disasters down there, something happens. A few years ago, there was the tornadoes in Joplin, Missouri. Well, 27 states responded to that event. And many of the resources that flowed in there were volunteer organizations and just people loading up their trucks with things and just coming into the community. It's unrealistic to think that we're going to have 27 states just kind of spontaneously respond up here in Alaska. So it's really incumbent upon us to be a little bit more prepared. Also, our supply lines are longer and a bit more delicate than we see in the lower 48. So we say here at DHS and EM that people should have enough supplies for 7 or more days. And when you start to look at all of those supplies for that home kit, 7 days worth of stuff is quite a bit. Just the water alone, we recommend that people have 1 gallon of water per person per day for drinking, hygiene, and cooking. So just there alone, if you have a family of five, that's 35 gallons of water. That can take up quite a bit of space. So to be fully prepared, we understand that it's not kind of something that's just going to fit in a shoebox. However, if all the space that you have is can just fit in a shoebox, then make your kit out of that shoebox and do the best you can with the stuff that fits in it. We want people to be prepared for 7 days, but just because you can't get to that level of preparedness doesn't mean you shouldn't take some steps to prepare.
Daisha, this is Scott. If you go to kpb.us, and Jeremy at the state also has a list, but for the locals, if you want to go to kpb.us, click on emergency management. At the top of our page, there's a link to be prepared. And there are printable supply lists there that come from ready.gov, the FEMA organization, that list everything from your prescription medications, infant formula, pet food, cash traveler's checks, the water that was just described, batteries for a flashlight, and radio, a weather radio. There's a pretty concise list. It would be one of those things you could put in your pocket that tells you the basic things. But it also recommends a 3-day supply. And in Alaska, as Jeremy said, we really encourage people to be prepared for 7.
And Chief Painter, I wondered if you could speak to this a little bit. I know for me, just like we were just discussing, you know, I think about, 35 gallons of water. It kind of starts to get overwhelming, when I've gone to put together my own personal emergency kit, I kind of start planning it and I think, oh boy, I've got to buy like all this stuff and it's going to take all this time. And yes, in an ideal world, we would have that much water and we would have all of our, you know, traveler's checks and cash and all these things. But what are kind of the essential things? Like if we knew there was going to be an earthquake tomorrow, we had some, you know, some sight into the future and we had the foresight and we could prepare today. What are the essential things that you would put into that kit if you just had to do it right now?
I think each individual has to look at their own situation and their own needs. And for some people, that could be medications. You know, do you have enough medication on hand, if you have prescription medication, to last a week or 2 weeks? And that's something to consider. We focus on water and food because those are kind of the necessities of life. And, you know, you can go for a couple of weeks without much food, but you can't go more than a few days without water. But there are all alternatives to storing water. If you have a 50-gallon hot water tank, there's usually about 50 gallons of water in that tank, as long as the tank isn't damaged and ruptured, that you can get water out of your water tank from a hot water heater. So there's alternatives. Scott mentioned some of the information that's available online. There's different websites, ready.gov and FEMA.gov, redcross.org, that have list and list of resources that you can, even if you can't go out today and purchase everything you need for a week, they have plans and schedules where you can do one thing a week and slowly over time put together your emergency kit. One thing you need to remember, though, is that things eventually spoil or outdate, so you have to rotate that stock back into what you normally use and replace it back in your disaster supplies. So you always have a cash on hand of, what Jeremy said, at least a week before we could count on help coming from outside. The larger the event, the longer it's going to take to get help from outside.
So food, water, medications, infant formula, if you have an infant, if you have a pet, think about that they're going to have to eat something too.
And drink, yeah.
And drink, and some cash is a good idea, correct?
Absolutely. If the power's out, people can't apparently run credit card machines without electricity. So you may not be able to charge. In a disaster, they may not be willing to take a personal check. So cash may be your only alternative, or a barter or trade or something more basic than a credit economy or a paper economy.
And what about warm clothes and blankets in Alaska? I mean, right now it's chilly outside, and it is a lot of the time. And if the power's out, gas is out, we'll need warm stuff too, right?
Yeah, at least I think Alaskans, if anybody, are used to dealing with the different variations of the weather, cold, wet, cold and wet, cold, windy and wet. So I think we're fairly well prepared as long as we can access where those items normally are. What you have to consider, though, is not only having a plan for home and work, but have a plan when you're on vacation somewhere, you're on the road, and some type of a modified kit in your vehicle that contains the essentials that you would need. And they make very lightweight and portable emergency shelters, space blankets and things that don't take up a lot of room, but they provide adequate heat to keep you from freezing.
And what about a first aid kit? Is that something also that might be good?
Absolutely. One of the dangers of an event is that you suffer an injury, a laceration, an abrasion, a burn. So put together a basic first aid kit that can take care of most minor injuries and wounds on your own. And that helps eliminate the overload of emergency rooms and doctor's offices after a disaster, taking care of minor injuries that can be dealt with at home.
And what about some things that maybe we haven't thought about? I know at KBBI, one of the things that we put on our list recently was toilet paper. And also, like, we're getting some little basically honey buckets, you know, in case we can't go to the regular bathroom.
Sure.
Yeah, some of the things that people don't think of are the personal hygiene items as well, things like Purell, trash bags to clean up, some rubber gloves, the honey bucket, as you mentioned, plenty of toilet paper. Also, you know, flashlights and lanterns, that type of things, with extra batteries, crank-operated radio, also some comfort items if you have kids, some nice stuffed animal or something that's going to give them a little bit of reprieve from the stress of the event. Even things like a deck of cards, something that you can use to pass the time and get your mind off of the disaster event. Also, an emergency toolkit, a small toolkit that you can use. Utility knife, plastic sheeting, duct tape, of course, is useful in an emergency. So all of those kind of items, but really it's just kind of a guide. You have to look at what you have in your home and what your family's needs are and then build your kit around that.
Okay, we're going to go to another caller. We have Tom on line two. Tom?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I was going to point out that I think that these...
Tom, could you turn off your radio in the background?
Okay.
Thank you. And then go ahead with your question.
I just want to point out that preparedness for earthquakes involves not only local, but it should be worldwide effort. It's like this problem in Japan with that nuclear power plant. It's radiating their oceans and the world. And unless we get our national grid stabilized, our life on this planet may not be that long. And I just wanted that thrown in there.
All right. So it's not only a state and local preparedness project, it's a national and international project. And I'm sure you all would agree.
Yes. One of the things that the state participates in is an international shakeout drill. We call it the Great, here in Alaska, we call it the Great Alaska Shakeout. But about 20 million people participated worldwide, and it's just an annual drop, cover, and hold on drill that we participate in, and we do that in October. Last year, in 2015, we had over 120,000 Alaskans participate in that. So if people would like to participate in an international earthquake safety drill, they can do that in October. Just take a look at shakeout.org, and they can register for the Alaska Great Alaska Shakeout.
Okay, thanks for that information. We're going to go to Scott on line three. He has a question about retail gas availability.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. The Katrina experience that I was in the area for, the hurricane wiped out, of course, like everything, it seemed like, and there were long gas lines at a very few stations that had electrical backup. And so when we had some of our events up here, volcanoes and so on going off, I called around to the retail gas outlets, and none of them seemed to be set up, at least at that time, to have an electrical backup. And credit cards don't work, I guess, but also the retail pumps don't work. And so I'm just curious if that's still true today, as far as you know.
Is that still true?
I think it is still true. I don't think there's a requirement for them to have emergency backup. Part of the planning that we have to do area-wide is what do we do for emergency vehicles, for example, in a long-term issue, and how do we help the citizens that need that? You know, there might be some, might need to be a need to ration gas or whatever it might be. But ultimately, what the idea would be to try to support them with some kind of a alternative power or mobile power for at least a few sites as time goes on for recovery. But I don't believe at this time there's any requirement for that backup. Chief Painter may have more information on that than me.
There's nothing, as far as I know. That's something that, you know, that we promote in continuity of operation planning for businesses, is that especially the businesses that provide a critical service, health, safety, fuel, power, the energy grid, all those companies need to have a plan of how to provide their services in a disaster, following a disaster, with limited availability of power. If you can't get power to the pumps, you can't run the pump, you can't run the credit card machine, even if they have a cash method, they should be. And I don't know how much we can promote and provide financial assistance for private businesses to have standby power available or emergency power available, but that's definitely something that needs to happen.
We're getting close to the end of our time here for our coffee table program, but real quick, since we're talking about power, I know that a backup generator is also something that people could invest in, and I know that, Scott, you were telling me that there are some backup generators that are strategically placed around the region. Can you touch on that real briefly?
Yeah, there are areas that would need power in support of community needs. For example, maybe the food bank and their large freezers. A more remote site like Cooper Landing might not have the immediate funds to put in a generator in a community center for an evacuation shelter. So we have a few small generators that are mobile that have been provided under grants from the State Division of Homeland Security that are intended for use anywhere on the peninsula in public for a public need. If I need it for a shelter, we need to support a hospital or a clinic, we have these systems that we can move around the peninsula for that purpose. And rather than just keeping them stationary in a covered area and not used at all, we keep the maintenance up on them, and we also deploy them for storage to areas that otherwise would not have such power. And we can retrieve those and take them to a higher need, so they're not just locked into one place. But we have several of those across the peninsula, not a huge quantity. There's three or four. But we do have those available that we could deploy as well.
Great. We're going to go to Dennis online too for one more question here. He has a question about emergency radio and flashlights. Dennis, real quick, your question.
Yeah, well, it's not really totally a question. It's just a suggestion. In my kit, I put in a flashlight radio that has a hand crank solar and ports for charging your cell phones.
All right. Yeah, don't forget we have all these cell phones now, right?
Right. And this, you know, with contained in a box that's like 4x5x8, and it works really well.
Okay, thanks for your question. And we're getting ready to wrap it up here on the coffee table. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us. We had Bob Painter, chief of the Homer Fire Department, here in studio with us, and Scott Walden with the Kenai Peninsula Borough Office of Emergency Management, along with Jeremy Zittick with the Alaska Division of Homeland Security. Thank you all for joining us. And real quick, any last words if you'd like to get out there for people, encouraging them to prepare their kits?
Yeah, this is Jeremy. The state's website, ready.alaska.gov, has a 7-day emergency kit checklist. It's broken up into 12 weeks, so each week you collect a couple items, and then after 12 weeks you have enough supplies for 7 days.
Okay, great. Thank you so much.
I would like to give the community encouragement to contact Chief Painter for assistance in planning. Homer's very proactive in this preparedness realm.
Okay, we're going to have to take off. So thank you for joining us.